Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. We start with the good. And as we mentioned, Jim, we have a few days off before the next Republican presidential contest. That comes a week from today, April 5th, in the Badger State of Wisconsin, where the polls showed Ted Cruz with a slight lead over Donald Trump and a big lead over Donald Trump if John Kasich's not on the ballot. But John Kasich's not getting out, so that's only hypothetical. However, Cruz did get a shot in the arm today from the sitting governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, who, of course, at one time was also running for this presidential nomination. It seems like a long time ago that he was doing that, because it was. He got out in September and at the time said he hoped others got out so we could stop Donald Trump from becoming the Republican nominee. So it's not a big shock that he ended up endorsing Ted Cruz today, but he went on with Wisconsin talk show host Charlie Sykes and gave three reasons for why he was doing so. Here's the first.
I've chosen to endorse Ted Cruz to be the next president of the United States for three simple reasons. One, I just fundamentally believe that he is a constitutional conservative. And why that's important to me is I know as a governor and talking to other governors across the country, we need a leader in Washington who understands that our founders intended for the power really to be in the states and, most importantly, in the hands of the people.
And he also says that Ted Cruz has attacked some of the same problems that he's attacked in Wisconsin.
We know how to take on the big government special interest and really put the power back in the hands of the hardworking taxpayers. That's something, again, that Ted Cruz has not only talked about in this campaign, I think probably more than just about anybody out there in Washington, he has shown he is not afraid to take on the big government special interest, even sometimes when they're aligned with our own party.
Oh, and there's one other little reason why he picked Ted Cruz.
Third, a very practical point, and that is I just fundamentally believe if you look at the facts, you look at the numbers, that Ted Cruz is the best positioned by far to both win the nomination of the Republican Party and to then go on and defeat Hillary Clinton in the fall this year.
And you might say that, he picked Ted Cruz because he hates Donald Trump and Kasich has no chance. But Walker says that's not the case.
I wanted to make sure that I was supporting someone. I wasn't against something or against someone, but rather being for something, just as I've said many times in campaigns for governor. I want to be for something. And after a lot of time looking at speeches, looking at the records, looking at what the candidates not only say but what they have done in the past, it was an easy call for me to support Ted Cruz.
Pretty thorough recommendation there.
It is. Now, some folks might say, look, you know, Scott Walker left this race very early. He might argue he was very prescient when he talked about the challenge Trump would present to the Republican Party. He urged other candidates to leave the race and to unite around one non-Trump alternative. None of the other candidates took that advice. We saw all these guys staying in, usually at least a couple contests after it was pretty clear it was not going to work out for them. Some people might say, look, certainly would have done Ted Cruz some good if Scott Walker jumped on board way back when. But I think this is kind of a key indicator, a key moment. We'll see more if Cruz ends up winning Wisconsin. The case for John Kasich as the non-Trump alternative is getting weaker with each passing week. Cruz is the anti-Trump. And we'll see how this shakes out. I think the establishment is getting on board. It's time to put aside any past grievances and problems unless you want to have Donald Trump as the Republican nominee. And there are a lot of Republicans who don't want to see that come to pass. So the other thing also I'm going to observe is that there's something about in a race where you've found reasons to be frustrated, irritated, disappointed with almost everybody. It's interesting. I don't know about you, Greg. I feel kind of warm and fuzzy when I think of Scott Walker now.
Yeah.
he just seems so normal. And you know, maybe it's just the chaos of recent months. But, you know, I always liked him. I was kind of disappointed to see him leave the race so early. Greg, vanilla looks really good right now.
It's always been my favorite ice cream. What can I say? All right, on to the bad martini now. And this actually happened on Monday. But since we had Obama comparing communism and capitalism and really saying, what's the big difference? Do whatever works for you. That story kind of trumped this, but only for a day because this is a huge deal. This is from your colleague David French at National Review Online. When Disney says jump, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal doesn't just ask how high. He insults anyone who asks him to stand his ground. Today, Deal joined the GOP Governor's Hall of Shame, currently populated by Indiana Governor Mike Pence and Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, by bowing to corporate pressure and pledging to veto an extraordinarily narrow religious liberty bill. Deal, in fact, makes both Pence and Hutchinson look like profiles in courage. They, after all, at least had enough conviction to sign modified, watered-down religious freedom legislation. Deal couldn't muster the backbone to sign even a bill that the legislature had already gutted in response to threatened corporate boycotts. The Georgia bill that Deal refused to defend was modest in scope, and he goes on to list some of the very simple things, like allowing clergy to have the right to decide who they want to marry, allowing faith-based organizations to decide who they're going to hire and who gets to use their facilities and so forth. Jim, right after the Supreme Court decision on marriage last year, a lot of the Republicans said, well, let's move on to religious liberty. This is where we're going to stake our ground on the social conservative thing. We are going to stand and fight social conservatives. You can count on us. And then we saw Pence, who's a rock-rib conservative, Hutchinson, who we thought was the same way, and now Deal apparently is even worse. And for social conservatives who are worried about the Republicans having their interests and actually defending them, they're not getting a lot of confidence right now.
Deeply frustrated because, again, as you point out, oftentimes you'll see legislation on these sorts of topics, the LGBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and anybody else I'm forgetting in that category there. They'll say this is discriminatory, this is hateful, this is bigotry, we object. They say, all right, well, let's narrowly tailor it. Because, like, why would you object to the idea that, you know, clergy should have the right to approve who they're going to marry? Why would that be objectionable to anyone? Unless we want the state coming and saying, no, you have to marry these people, which is what we were always told all along was not what gay marriage was all about. It was not about forcing values on people. It was not about forcing people to do things they don't want. It was just about tolerance. It was just about understanding. It was just about love. Well, if that's the case, why is this law objectionable? And Deal basically plays into a pre-existing narrative that Republican lawmakers will always fold when it counts. They don't really have any principles. They're terrified of losing corporations. It also is really interesting, Greg, to see just how much, like, corporations have become big instruments of legislative power on social issues.
Yes.
Every time I hear about how corporate America is this, you know, Republican ally and, you know, a tool of the right wing and conservatives, look, you know, corporate America kicks conservatism's butt 6 days a week and twice on Sundays. It really is deeply frustrating, and it's an observation that, you know, it's interesting that Republicans get blamed for all the evil corporate CEOs, but at the same time, the evil corporate CEOs never have Republicans' backs when Republicans need them. So here is Nathan Deal knuckling under. I wouldn't pretend to be terribly familiar with the lawmaker, but people who are not the least bit surprised by this, and it appears he's done it in probably one of the most high profile and really deeply frustrating ways he possibly could.
Yes. And it's also an instrumental lesson when it comes to the left, because as we've seen in every stage of this debate, however back far you want to go, when it was the Lawrence v. Texas decision, a lot of them said this, we really don't have any interest in making gay marriage legal. And then after this, we're not going to ruin the freedoms of the clergy and all these other things coming down the pike. The left is never satisfied. You give them an inch, they're just going to keep wanting more and wanting more. So I think that's another important lesson to take away from here.
Indeed.
All right, on to the crazy martini now. And we've had clips from Ron Fournier of National Journal on many times before, a lot of times as it relates to the Hillary Clinton email scandal. He, I think, instinctively has a somewhat of a fondness for the Clintons since he followed them in Arkansas and then came to Washington when Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992. But he's a pretty straight shooter, and he's been very, very critical of Hillary on the email scandal, talking about how this was blatantly done to skirt FOIA laws and to not have a paper trail for the sake of history when Hillary set up this private server while she was Secretary of State. But now that we're getting news that the FBI is advancing in its investigation, they're giving the guy who set up the server immunity, and now they're scheduling interviews with top staffers, which will eventually include Hillary herself. Ron Fournier on Morning Joe on Monday with a curious interpretation of the laws that pertains to Hillary Clinton right now.
Legally, though, there's a big bar that you have to get over to prosecute anybody for these crimes, much less somebody who's running for president. And as critical as I've been of Hillary Clinton, and I am very critical of Hillary Clinton, I do understand that when somebody's running for president, there is a higher bar you have to get over, because we can't have a system in which we're constantly charging people who are running for president.
Actually, the bar
so
is a reckless use of classified information.
Equal justice under the law, Jim.
my interactions with Ron Fournier have generally been positive, but I there are a lot of people who find him utterly exasperating, particularly at his, you know, common a pox on both their houses. You know, Hillary Clinton's been terrible on this, but the Republicans are overreaching. They've made this so partisan, you know, and he'll spend, you know, do a pro forma denunciation of Democrats and then, you know, go at length what he really enjoys doing, which is ripping into Republicans and conservatives. On this one, he makes this assertion. There's just nothing to it. No, there is no legal argument. You have to meet a higher standard legally to charge a presidential candidate. There's a whole bunch of really unnerving ramifications from this argument. Among them, that we don't expect more out of presidential candidates than we do out of the average citizen. Two, that if you are running for president, the authorities, the FBI, law enforcement's got to give you a little more leeway, right? They can't just charge you for anything. They have to really have everything squared away than they would for an ordinary citizen. You have some sort of special rights, special privileges, special status. Joe Scarborough kind of scoffed at him and said, what statute is this presidential candidate exemption listed in there? But even the worst part of all is that I saw this and I just pictured like Rick Perry throwing an iPad across the room. Because, you know, we've already had presidential candidates prosecuted for crimes over like total nonsense, right? I mean, the Texas Court of Appeals threw out the entire charges against him for abuse of power, said this was completely within his rights and powers as governor. And in fact, some of these prosecutions represented a violation of his First Amendment rights. In Wisconsin, we had that hyper-partisan district attorney and the special prosecutor going after everybody they could connected to Scott Walker. These are very partisan efforts and abuse of power by prosecutors because they want to create embarrassing headlines for a presidential candidate. I don't think we can say that is what is at work here in this FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton. The FBI is not out to get Hillary Clinton. The evidence is right there clear that they have found dozens and dozens, and now we're up to hundreds and hundreds of classified information on a personal email system that was not cleared to operate that stuff and represented a security risk. There were rules about this. There were laws about this. So, you know, the headline, you know, Ron Fournier says something dumb is not like the most shocking and you know, grabbing headline possible. But it's sometimes when you see something like this, you got to push back and basically say, no, there is not a different legal standard for presidential candidates. And we shouldn't just blurt this out and assert that there is. Now, you could say politically or public relations wise or in, you know, in terms of perception, you want to have everything extra super duper squared away in a prosecuting presidential candidate. But that's different from saying legally, which is what he's saying here.
Well, the interviews have begun. Now they say they have to, going to take a while to do the interviews. That'll take weeks and weeks, and then they'll have to compare what's said in the emails with the facts that they have from the other investigation. So it's very unlikely we'll see anything until at least the end of the primary season, and who knows how long it'll take after that, and still, of course, whether the Justice Department will do anything with what the FBI actually hands over. So get comfy, everybody. This isn't going to end anytime soon.
Hey, you know what? Let it go on. Second best show in town.
Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.